Hey, well, good afternoon. Excuse me, bear with my voice. So, my name is Jim Vrsaljevic, and I want to thank Bruce Friedman and the organizers of Lab Infotech for inviting me to join with you today. It's my first time at this meeting, and so in a way, I guess I'm in strange territory, not being an an informatics specialist, but certainly confronted with the problems of managing data and information. That was a fantastic talk, so I've got a tough act to follow. And I'll do my best to try to make this relevant to medical informatics and to maybe shed some light on some of the challenges that we're facing, not only in infectious diseases and in medical microbiology, but more generally in clinical pathology and across the spectrum of our discipline known as pathology. I am working at Texas Children's Hospital, as Bob mentioned earlier, in Houston, and my disclosures are listed there. I wanted to first give credit to the team, and we talked about teams earlier and the shift towards teams, and certainly we're seeing that in laboratories, and it's fundamental to appreciate that. And of course, I come here as a representative of this particular team, our molecular microbiology team at Texas Children's. So, I wanted to start out by just showing that we're really dealing with bench-to-bench science and in clinical pathology, and that is making discoveries at the bench, but instead of moving directly to the bedside, we move to the diagnostic laboratory. And we are in the process of this transformation into the molecular age, which is still a very active process. We've been hearing about molecular medicine for a long time, but it takes quite a long time for these changes to occur, and we're now beginning to see the real shifts in diagnosis from purely morphological, even in microbiology as well as in anatomic pathology, to quantitative information and other types of molecular data. Real-time PCR may indicate simply presence or absence, and we'll talk about each of these during this talk. And additionally, DNA sequencing and pyrosequencing is now the basis for what's being regarded as next generation or next gen sequencing. And at the end, we'll get into the microbiome piece. And then rep PCR and a variety of DNA typing approaches that allow us to track pathogens using microfluidics. So we've got different kinds of data sets. And representing and summarizing these data sets will certainly be a challenge. And I'll show some examples of some of the reports, too. These are the highlights of this talk today, and just to emphasize some key points that I'll be addressing. One is pathogen identification, but we could just as well be talking about mutation identification, diagnosis of tumors or human genetic diseases, tracking of individual drug-resistant pathogens or strains, again, getting beyond the species level, and this is certainly a resolution issue and one in which again, we're confronted in other areas of the laboratory with respect to individual mutations, enteric pathogens, and I'm going to focus on Clostridium difficile in this case and just the change in our ability to diagnose infections and what that implications for reporting. And finally, we'll get to respiratory pathogens. Now, let me start out by just addressing the issue of DNA sequencing. And these are really examples of different molecular methodologies. We talk about omics, but we're going to start simplistically here to address some of the fundamental shifts that are going on in the clinical laboratory and the issues that we may have to think about very soon, already in some cases, but much more so in the very near future, as to how, specifically, how we need to consider the integration of different data types, morphologic data as well as molecular data. And DNA sequencing in the microbiology laboratory as well as in the genetics laboratory is certainly making a large impact and is allowing us to refine our diagnoses, but also introducing some challenges in terms of how we apply informatics in the laboratory. And these are just some examples of pathogens that I won't describe in detail, but just to mention that we have a variety of pathogens listed here that may be very difficult to diagnose using conventional microbiology, and we currently need modern approaches such as DNA sequencing for the identification. So Steve just talked about workflow in the laboratory. We had to redefine our work processes because of the advent of technology. And in the first talk, we addressed disruptive technologies, or creative destruction, as Alan Greenspan refers to it, in the age of turbulence. And it clearly, these new technologies make us think about our work processes and flows between laboratories. The microbiology laboratory was effectively segregated from the molecular laboratory until late 2003, when we implemented routine DNA sequencing for pathogen identification. And now we had a flow occurring directly from the microbiology laboratory to a laboratory across the hall, fortunately nearby, but now we had molecular data. And that molecular information now has to make its way back to the context. We could be considering anatomic pathology in the histology laboratory and then referring to molecular oncology, which we're also doing in our own department. And we've had to really think about these feedback loops and how the information at the bench level within the laboratories now, not necessarily including the pathologist, but this may be strictly between medical technologists, lab managers, and at some point, of course, the pathologist will need to be involved in integrating information. At the time we implemented this in December 2003, of course, we were one of very few, a handful of institutions around the country performing this routinely, and we summarized the experience a couple of years ago in a publication in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology. And these are the numbers at the time, and this has expanded considerably since then, since July of 06. But the key point is that approximately 90% of the isolates that could not be identified previously by biochemical testing were now being 90% of those isolates that could not be identified by biochemical testing were being identified by prior sequencing. Now, this was less than 5% of the total, and that's been expanding somewhat. But it's important to keep in mind that we didn't have an answer before, and now we do. And so now we have to link these processes and, of course, begin to think about new species identifications, new data, if you will. And this is an example of a clinical case, a patient with chronic myelogenous leukemia, status bone marrow transplantation, post-bone marrow transplantation, developing meningitis and succumbing to this encephalopathy and ependymitis. And this is at autopsy, and before we would just look at this and wonder, and now we have the ability to do DNA sequencing directly from the sections and the slides in some cases if we have sufficient material to work with, and we can make a diagnosis. And we relate that back to the histopathology. And, of course, this has been a very powerful technique now that is being applied in different clinical laboratories. Another example, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, a pathogen that can be readily cultured in laboratories, but yet in certain cases cannot be successfully identified just because the isolates are atypical and very difficult to identify biochemically. And this happens frequently in the context of cystic fibrosis. Again, I'm just trying to put this into a medical context for you. And then additionally, we've got this challenge then of trying to identify organisms that may be routinely identified. In some cases, now we have a challenge, and DNA sequencing has yielded fruit by enabling us to identify these pathogens. And this is an example of the workflow then in the molecular laboratory. We have DNA extraction, we have to amplify the DNA, and then perform DNA sequencing. And, of course, a variety of molecular labs are performing these tests now routinely. But we're now generating sequence data and uncovering new pathogens, re-emerging pathogens, as well as familiar faces. We generate DNA sequence information with a pyrogram, and now we have to query databases that are available through the internet and local databases too that we can utilize to enable us to then come up with a diagnosis. And this has been very helpful, and you can see the increase, and this has increased significantly already in 2009 in the application of DNA sequencing in the clinical laboratories. Again, another example, the pyrogram, the data set that we're generating. And what's interesting about this is that we just heard a beautiful talk and partly referred to quality in the laboratory. The molecular information that we're gathering now and that we have is information locally is enabling us now to go back to microbial identification and misidentification, or misdiagnosis, if you will. And we're now able to create these feedback loops, as I mentioned earlier. And in numerous instances, we have redefined our approach in the microbiology laboratory prior to sequencing based on our findings. We're now able to provide critical feedback back to the microbiologist who may not be performing any molecular testing. And because we have now more specific, accurate information, now we can drive improvement in those processes. Sometimes we simply can't get around the fact that we need to do DNA sequencing, but we have also refined the processes to increase the accuracy and quality of testing because of this additional information. Again, not knowing what it was really didn't help us, and we couldn't improve quality in the laboratory, but with this information we can. Quite frankly, we're just beginning to grapple with how to fully utilize molecular data in the laboratory to drive quality enhancement. Clearly, this is something that's going to have to fully engage our IS specialists, our informatics community, to fully harness this. But this is something that's going to be confronting pathology across the board in different areas, hematopathology, genetics, certainly in the area of oncology and coagulation. And if we start thinking about the implications in terms of pharmacogenetics and enabling us to improve management approaches, there's a tremendous amount of data that we will be able to harness to improve quality. This is the report for sequencing. Very simple, of course. We just have one answer. But the power of this is that it's a global approach. We are not thinking first what is that pathogen. As with many first-generation molecular tests, we had to have some idea. We had to make a best guess to order a specific test. But like culture now, we can ask a very global question and get a specific answer. Now, let's shift gears and delve into DNA typing or molecular epidemiology. Another approach, but hopefully it may emphasize or highlight some different issues. In this case, I'm just emphasizing Pseudomonas aeruginosa, again, as an important pathogen in the laboratory that causes a variety of infections, and clearly infectious diseases impacts a number of specialties throughout the hospital. In this case, these organisms may be multi-drug resistant, and certainly this phenotype is not confined to Pseudomonas, but a variety of infectious agents, and you see the drug classes indicated here. We're performing routine susceptibility testing in the laboratory, but now we have the ability to do things we simply couldn't do 10 years ago, and that is by applying microfluidics and molecular typing, we can then discern the individual strains that may be causing an infection. Now, I will highlight that in addition to PCR-based typing, there are other methodologies such as pulse field gel electrophoresis, rapid typing, ribotyping, a variety of approaches. We are specifically using microfluidics and PCR-based typing. Again, the variety of strategies are illustrated on this slide. And this central one is the one that we're applying in the laboratory, but clearly there are a variety of approaches. But now we have the ability, as I mentioned, to highlight which specific bacterial clone may be causing infection, and whether a particular strain or clone is associated with a disease outbreak in a hospital setting, for example. This is another illustration of the workflow. In this case, we're culturing organisms. We may be working closely with another team, our infection control team in the hospital, clinicians as well as the nursing staff. And by having this ongoing dialogue, we may be able to identify particular cultures of interest in the laboratory. Again, just consider these any clinical specimen. We then extract nucleic acid, perform PCR-based DNA typing, and now we have a different kind of data set information that we can now use to compare a variety of strains of the same species. Now, what's the real point here? The key point is that we can track individual infectious agents in the hospital, and you can see that there's a dominant clone shown by this prominent maroon bar on this slide. We've been tracking that for several years in our Cystic Fibrosis Center in collaboration with other physicians. And now by working with the medical staff, we have information that's qualitatively very different than DNA sequencing, where we might have a series of bases that enable us to identify a certain pathogen, go back to our practice and why we missed it. Could we do better in the laboratory? Maybe we simply need molecular data. In this case, we are enhancing resolution at a different level. Instead of coming up with a species identification, or calling a gene, if you will, now we're able to distinguish different strains or clones of bacteria. And this scatter plot represents the data in a non-hierarchical fashion. We now see a dominant clone here. This cluster represents this single dominant clone of multidrug-resistant Pseudomonas. And we can now track this over time to see whether this grows in size or whether we begin to see the evolution of subclones, different spots indicated elsewhere on this slide that represent other strains causing infections. We have a report that we utilize both internally and with referred testing to signify whether isolates may be indistinguishable by molecular typing. These isolates, of course, may be clearly distinguishable, representing different clones and may be unrelated genetically. That may be very useful information to the healthcare team. It means that that particular clone, there's not one dominant clone, but variety, but instead maybe multiple strains and not a single point source. If there is a single clone, that may point out a single source of the infection, and then clearly one may intervene to look for the source of a particular dominant clone. So this information may be very helpful to our medical colleagues to help to change clinical practices in individual healthcare units. And we've been utilizing that to create now a conversation, a dialogue between the laboratory and our intensive care units, for example, our neonatal ICUs, our pediatric ICUs. We have been confronted with certain potential specific outbreaks caused by particular drug-resistant pathogens, not necessarily Pseudomonas. And by having the ability to track these individual clones in different healthcare settings, we've now been able to intervene and work closely with nurses and physicians to modify healthcare practices. Again, now we have the feedback improving quality in the healthcare setting, but not simply within the Department of Pathology or within the laboratory, but now going out to the primary healthcare setting. And this may include different clinical environments in our cystic fibrosis setting. By implementing the DNA typing scheme, we have been able to manage the spread of this clone, and presumably certain clones may be more readily transmissible. And we were able to intervene and place several of these children in contact isolation in the Cystic Fibrosis Center, and that way minimizing this facile transmission between individuals. Now, one thing we haven't yet confronted, although we're thinking about it, is how to potentially connect this data with spatial representations in the hospital and how to integrate this data more successfully in the reports. We do have comprehensive reports that include the graphical representation of the data set with the text representations. And so we're thinking about different ways of representing the data, again, helping to drive improvements in quality, not only in the laboratory, but throughout the hospital and the clinic setting. So molecular typing in this case could help redefine infection control. Now, a different challenge, and that is Clostridium difficile, as an example, is a cause of antibiotic-associated diseases. So we use antibiotics to treat infections, but yet, paradoxically, the antibiotics may then cause the emergence of certain pathogens. However, we may also be dealing with colonization in very young children. And so we have a number of challenges with respect to intestinal infections, but I'm just simply going to focus on the example of Clostridium difficile, which continues to be a major medical management challenge in the United States and in other parts of the world. And it's clearly an iatrogenic infection, one in which treatment really does help to cause the emergence of this organism, toxin-producing bacteria called Clostridium difficile. Particular strains then have toxin genes and may produce these toxins, and we found that using DNA testing, we may be able to dramatically improve sensitivity of detection and yielding an accurate diagnosis We've effectively doubled the detection rate of C. difficile in our healthcare setting. The bottom line is that we were missing about 50% of cases. And this is not unusual. We are now beginning to see this replicated in many different centers around the country. And so having inadequate diagnostic tools simply created this ignorance about this infection. And now, because of improved molecular diagnostic tools, we now can make an accurate diagnosis much more frequently, causing now physicians to second-guess their antimicrobial therapies and enabling them to institute proper strategies, such as withdrawal of certain antibiotics, implementation of different classes of antibiotics to control this infection. There are specific antimicrobial agents that can be called upon in the context of C. difficile infection. But the other issue is that we're now also expanding our appreciation for antibiotics that may predispose individuals to this kind of an infection. Again, helping to drive quality by enabling more accurate diagnosis. That more accurate diagnosis now can help physicians assess their management schemes using antibiotics. So again, the drive to increase quality via molecular testing. And this report is a quite simple. It's either positive or negative, but we also include notes in these reports so we can guide physicians that may be confronted with a positive test in an infant. And we know that many infants are not susceptible to infection because they lack the presence of toxin receptors on their epithelial cells. We can help guide them through the laboratory information system. And then a variety of other points that we make on this and many other molecular tests. Now, I'm going to transition to respiratory tract infections to also shift towards the omics part of the talk. We've been focusing for the first part of the talk on single pathogens, a variety of molecular tools, the feedback loops and conversations that are now beginning to occur for the first time between the laboratory and other laboratories as well as the healthcare setting. But now we're entering a new era, and that is with the ability to assess individuals simultaneously for the presence of a variety of infectious agents. We're now confronted with new paradigms, and this is where omics really comes into play. Now, there are a variety of molecular methodologies used currently in the clinical laboratory, but it's important to emphasize that multiplex testing using liquid bead arrays and solid phase-based microarrays or gene trips have arrived. And one such example is the Luminex technology. Luminex is a company based in Austin, Texas, and Panomics is a company developing particular kits. There are a variety of other companies that are also developing tools for this platform. And basically, it's a way of addressing the presence of multiple proteins or nucleic acid targets in solution. And the power of this technology is that you have spectrally addressable small polystyrene beads that can be coated with either antibodies or oligonucleotides. And those oligos and antibodies can recognize particular protein or DNA RNA targets. And this is basically a flow cytometer adapted to molecular detection. Now, the respiratory viral panels, and I guess it's appropriate that we're talking about respiratory viruses in this time of year. The first respiratory viral panel and really the first application of arrays to diagnostics and infectious diseases was FDA approved more than a year ago in January 2008. Now, this was a landmark development because now, for the first time, arrays were going to be deployed in the clinical laboratory routinely for the diagnosis of respiratory infections, and we're beginning now to see rapid development of a number of array-based tests in infectious diseases, oncology, in different areas in the laboratory. This is an example of array-based respiratory virus detection, liquid bead arrays using the RMA technology, and I won't belabor you with the molecular details of the test, but I simply want to point out now that the power of this technology is immense for delivering a diagnosis now. In this one study, almost 72% of clinical specimens yielded a specific diagnosis by liquid beta ray technology, compared to just over 23% with the prior state-of-the-art DFA and viral culture immunofluorescence studies. And this was a study using nasal wash samples from five-year-old children. And so, again, this highlights that rapid and large-scale improvements in the ability to diagnose infections are occurring now, literally as we speak. A number of new tests are being developed so that we have the ability now to establish diagnosis and to also track these infections and do much more sophisticated epidemiologic studies that clearly have implications for public health strategies. We talk a lot about healthcare, and certainly we're seeing a lot of this talk out of Washington lately, but I think it's important to, as I'm sure most of us are thinking in this room, we certainly want to avoid squelching innovation, and I guess it's one of my biggest concerns right now with so much talk about affordability and access to healthcare. I hope we don't lose sight of quality, and the fact is that rapid implementation of new technology is certainly enabling us to improve the quality of diagnostics and in areas throughout pathology. So this is an example of a respiratory virus panel report, very different than what we've seen recently and that we continue to see in many clinical laboratories. We see many more viruses now listed, and we see many that are simply not detected. Now, clearly, because we can probe for more viruses, we are getting many more negatives, and this may drive up the cost of laboratory testing. There's no doubt about it. But the reality is that we're also able to deliver a diagnosis much more frequently. And not only may this help us improve antiviral strategies in this context, but it may help exclude many other diagnoses and may lead physicians to more rapidly discharge or more appropriately triage patients in the emergency room. And so there are many costs downstream of the laboratory that may be affected by improved molecular testing, whether we're talking about omics or single molecular targets. Clearly, as Steve Rabb pointed out in the prior lecture, I think the clinical laboratory could be, if we manage it properly, could be an important driver in enhancing the quality of healthcare. And it won't be confined to the laboratory. It's important to consider that a variety of studies have estimated that currently in the United States, about 5% of healthcare costs are directly attributable to laboratory testing. It's really quite a small figure. Roughly 70 to 75%, and the number will vary a bit depending on the study, but roughly 70 to 75% of medical decision-making is driven by laboratory testing, and we can include anatomic and clinical pathology in that and combine it all. So clearly, a small portion of that pie called healthcare costs affects the majority of medical decision-making in this country and certainly throughout the developed world. And so the revolution that we're seeing now with array-based testing may certainly help guide us to much more accurate management strategies and hopefully save costs, not on the diagnostic end, because I think what's going to happen with the continued evolution of molecular testing, if we get the informatics right, and with online physician ordering being now rapidly disseminated around the country in a more uniform electronic medical record, etc., we have an opportunity to drive down healthcare costs, despite the fact that lab tests, the costs of lab tests may actually increase. We may be looking at 10% of that healthcare pie being diagnostic testing in the future. But the informatics, I think, will be crucial in reducing the overall healthcare cost by enabling physicians to more appropriately manage healthcare and in the aggregate drive down the costs of pharmaceuticals. We'll see. But I think there's real hope, and I think this is where pathology can be a driver. Getting back to a boring tech slide, the respiratory virus panel report can be extended, and it has, and I have to give credit to Viracor for providing this for this talk. This is an example of additional information that may be provided and enabling the laboratory, in this case, to consider that a negative result may need to be confirmed again with another laboratory test. But clearly, this information may also include management information, again, helping to guide therapy as we begin to distill larger data sets into clinically meaningful information. So we've entered the era of arrays. We could be talking about microarrays, gene chips, liquid bead arrays. Let's just leave it as arrays and include it all because it's here today. And there are a number of applications emerging from the research setting, and I should highlight rapidly emerging from the research laboratories, several laboratories around the United States now, that could have quite an impact in clinical pathology and specifically in microbiology, but this could be readily applied in a variety of different contexts. The ViraChip has been developed and has been published. Note this publication date, 2002. David Wang and others have been furiously working on next-generation ViraChips. This particular array had greater than 140 viruses represented. It's important to point out that there is built-in redundancy into these solid phase chips used for detection of a variety of viruses. And it's also important to point out that they haven't biased the chips with respect to human viruses, but have included plant and animal viruses and have made some interesting discoveries regarding pathogens that were heretofore underappreciated or unknown. The built-in redundancies, though, also introduce major challenges in terms of informatics. And right now, the informatics tools are simply not there in most clinical laboratories. And these scientists have written new code for interpreting these kinds of data sets. They're really fundamentally different. And so, again, another challenge for the hardcore informatics specialists is then to basically port these informatics strategies into the clinical laboratory to be able to discern this pattern as that belonging to a human rhinovirus or a parainfluenza virus. Now, another example that extends beyond viruses to bacterial pathogens is called the PhyloChip. And this has been developed largely at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in the Bay Area in California. And from LBNL, it's made its way to UCSF. And you can see in this paper, Flanagan, Sue Lynch, and others have been deploying this technology at the University of California at San Francisco. The G2 chip, as it's currently called, has more than 8,000 taxa per chip with a built-in redundancy of 11 probes per taxa. That G3 chip that is expected to be released in September 2009 will have greater than 30,000 taxa per chip. The cost of the chip now is approximately $250 to $300 per run. Contrast that with the next generation sequencing run for a comparable data set that would run at least $2,000. The prices of sequencing is dropping rapidly, but DNA microarray technology remains quite cost effective, not just for gene expression profiling in humans, but for novel applications such as pathogen detection. And what's interesting is that now we can begin to assess the complexity of entire microbial communities and begin to ask entirely new sets of questions in the clinical environment. And that is, for example, do antibiotics or any other treatment strategy, for that part, cancer chemotherapy, alter microbial communities and thereby alter human physiology? And I'll get to the human microbiome in just a moment. But using the PhyloChip technology in this study, which is really one of the first publications published in June 2007, less than 2 years ago, they highlighted the fact that with antimicrobial therapy in patients intubated in an ICU setting, that they could track relative distributions of microbes, not necessarily pathogens, but these are commensal bacteria in the respiratory tract, and they detected reduction in mean organisms, 16.2 to 5.6, so not surprisingly, a reduction in the complexity of the microbial community with antibiotic therapy. Interestingly, though, the loss of bacterial diversity now, looking at the community level, Let's think of this as metabiology now. We're in the area of the metabiology, metagenomics, metatranscriptomics, metaproteomics. The loss of bacterial diversity was correlated with ventilator-associated pneumonia in patients receiving antibiotic therapy. Now, it was impossible, really, to assess this before the development of the PhyloChip. And so, again, a disruptive technology is not only creating the ability to ask new sets of questions, but certainly enabling us now to assess quality, to assess the effectiveness, the efficacy of antibiotic strategies, and whether we may be causing more problems in certain patients, and what are really the optimal doses and timelines for antibiotic therapy. And what you see here, basically fluctuations in different bacterial populations, and we may be examining such fluctuations in communities in the very near future in the clinical laboratory. In fact, in February of this year, we established the Texas Children's Microbiome Center as the first hospital-based microbiome center in the United States to begin to really drive this technology into the clinical laboratory. Now, we started with this slide of bench to bench, and I haven't included really the omics piece on this slide, but clearly omics is now moving from bench to bench. And I have to finish with one of my favorite topics, the Human Microbiome Project, because this is a topic about microbiology, but it's also a topic about the challenges in information science and the relevance to human medicine. Your body is a planet. This was depicted in Discover magazine in the summer of 2007, less than 2 years ago. And it's become a very popular topic in the media, and many people are interested in this, and this interest led to the Roadmap Project, the National Institutes of Health Roadmap version 1.5. In 2007, Elias Zerhouni signed off on the Human Microbiome Project. This, of course, followed the Human Genome Project as the next massive human genome project. Think about this as human genome version 2.0, if you will. And we know that our bodies, not only our skin, but inside the gastrointestinal tract, the oral cavity, the respiratory tract, the genitourinary tract, are coated with complex microbial communities. And many of these organisms have been unappreciated, unknown until recently. As next-generation DNA sequencing is now being applied vigorously in the genome centers around the United States, but also in many centers outside of the genome centers. And this slide simply highlights the Human Microbiome Project and the fact that just a few years ago, in 2005, in a publication from Stanford and David Relman's group, surveying a few human individuals, more than 60% of the sequences were entirely novel and not present in any database, and more than 80% of these organisms were considered unculturable, thereby not diagnosable in the clinical laboratory. We're now addressing the core question in the project as it's now officially started, and the sequences are now, the sequence data is now being generated in four centers, primarily at the J. Craig Venter Institute in Maryland, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at the Broad Institute, at Washington University, and at Baylor in Houston. And we're now asking the fundamental question, is there a core human microbiome? Is there a variable microbiome? And how might that impact human health and disease? So without belaboring that, this is just a figure and an illustration of where we're headed. And this will certainly have an impact in medicine and in pathology, more specifically in the clinical laboratory. And that is, are we really talking about microbes ultimately or sets of genes? The gene content of the human microbiome is estimated to be 100-fold greater than the gene content of the human genome. And so the informatics piece by itself is staggering. And entirely new tools are now being forced into development. Necessity is the mother of invention, right? The genome centers are grappling with that. At our latest face-to-face meeting in Cambridge, Massachusetts in January, it was blatantly clear that we had to really manage data sets in new ways, and we're now talking about clinical metadata sets because up to 250 human subjects are now being sampled in St. Louis and Houston, and they're being sampled at various body sites, including the nose, the skin, the oral cavity, intestinal samples, and the genitourinary tract. And we're doing a very comprehensive assessment of the human microbiome, but we're tying that into clinical metadata sets and clinical and the human genome data that is being obtained by peripheral blood draws. And so now we're beginning to think about whole new, much larger data sets and the potential connections between these data sets in a project that is simply at the research stage right now to assess the microbiome in healthy human adults. But it is raising a large number of very intriguing questions, some that are specific to microbiology, but some that are generally applicable to medicine as we enter this omics era and as we begin to apply the omic sciences in the clinical laboratory. And so in this very recent paper in 2009, just within the past couple of months, from Jeff Gordon's group at Washington University, they ask this fundamental question, and they show fluctuations in microbial communities in mothers and their twins. They also show differences in a relative stability in the composition of certain gene sets. These are the COG categories used to characterize gene families. And we're now beginning to assess whole sets of genes and families of genes in these microbial communities. And we're beginning to realize that this may have important implications for human health. So it's clearly a new era in science and medicine, and we're just, again, beginning to grapple with the vastness of the data, and somehow we're going to have to distill the data sets in the clinical laboratory, and hopefully, ultimately, this will drive improvements in medical management and disease prevention. So to summarize, we have a variety of challenges with respect to pathogen identification and mutation or DNA sequence detection, more generally speaking, and the ability to generate answers, i.e. sequencing particular pathogens and deliver diagnosis, has certainly helped us improve the laboratory processes in microbiology as a field, and it's been an example of driving quality improvement within the laboratory with new molecular tools. The ability to track drug-resistant pathogens using microfluidics and PCR-based chromosomal DNA profiling has enabled us to initiate newer and deeper dialogues with our physician colleagues about the management of patients and the control of potential pathogens in different healthcare units, ultimately reducing nosocomial infections and improving healthcare practices. The ability to detect certain pathogens such as Clostridium difficile by real-time PCR has enabled us to effectively double the detection rate and affect our antimicrobial management strategies in the clinic. Newer array-based multiplex molecular strategies are enabling us not only to detect new viruses, but to assess microbial communities and shifts in those communities that may have real implications for human health. And a tie between that and the topic of C. difficile comes out of some of the work being performed at the University of Michigan by Vince Young and colleagues, showing that evidence now, preliminary evidence, but data indicating that particular microbial communities may be useful in predicting susceptibility to antimicrobial-associated infections. And so the ability to study these fluxes may have real implications in terms of medical management and disease prevention. Thanks very much.